Is everybody else hot in here? I'm hot. You don't mind if I take off my coat then, do you? And I've got a sleep disorder and have to sleep with a breathing machine. And the first night in Kenya, Brian heard in the middle of the night a poof, and that was the end of my breathing machine. And so I didn't have anything to help me keep my throat open so I wouldn't choke and I wouldn't keep on waking up. And I am a basket case without that within a day or so. I can last a night or whatever, but I knew it was going to be a long haul, and I tried to find one there, and they didn't have one. I did find a Puritan Bennett dealer, really by mistake I found him, and he could have got me one, but it had taken a couple weeks. And I knew I was in a long haul. I was going to email Sue and have her send another machine I have from here. But I knew that would probably take 6 weeks. So I had to live without it. And the first night without it was I had a hard time. I was continually waking up, and I wasn't sleeping, and I was restless. And I ended up getting out of bed two or three times during the night, kneeling and praying, and I finally, in my discussions with the Lord, talked to him, and I finally told him, "You'd sent me here, and he was going to have to take care of that problem, and I had to get sleep to function, and that I had a lot of things to go do. We had scheduled services every day for 6 weeks, and that it was in his hands." And I climbed back up in the bed, and I slept, and I'm not saying I slept perfect, but I slept better than I've ever slept without that machine. And I was able to function. I did get a hold of Sue a couple days later. She did send me one. That was a blessing. It got there in 4 days or 3 days. And it was in one piece, and nobody had stolen the insides out of it. And that was a blessing. And so I was very thankful for that. I can't tell you how that was much of a concern that was for me. How in the times past that when I've been without it, it's really been a problem. I was blessed several other times in beginning to get sick when I was administering to we at one service administered to about 35 people, and I became faint because I hadn't eaten, and it was hot, and I thought I was going to pass out. I started getting dizzy and lightheaded. I just prayed in a silent prayer, and a breeze came up and cooled me off, and it was just wonderful. I'm thankful for the avenue of prayer, that I could go to our Heavenly Father and ask Him for the help in time of need. We had made a contact last trip with a lady down in Narok, which is a different village, a different tribe. About 3.5 hours away from where we were, and she had asked us to come and preach at her congregation, and Brother Brian McIndoo said that we would, and we had stopped there on the way in and talking to her brother, and we said that we'd call her back. And we had a telephone number, and we had tried to call, and it was getting close to the time of day or time of the week that we were scheduled there. It was a day or two before Sunday, and we hadn't been able to make contact. And we had been praying about that we'd be able to make contact. That night I went to sleep, was woken in the middle of the night, and got up, went over to the newspaper and turned open the page, and on that page it said that the area code in the town that we were trying to contact had been changed, and there was a new area code. So we had to call that number, and called the number the next morning and made contact and had a nice service. One of the things we were concerned about after leaving there last time is what would happen there for the next 3 months without any ministry and without being able to support the members that we had baptized the last time. And we had left a committee in charge of the activities and had gave them some instructions on what to teach and gave them some funds to be able to transfer to get a matatu or a taxi to get there. You know, there is no public transportation that's worth anything in Kenya. The roads don't exist. They're not safe when they are. We got on one road, a back road, and it was pouring rain, and we ended up on two wheels, and I thought we were going to fall over, and it's something else. But so we had to help them with some transportation, and we left, and we're worried, and I know a lot of people prayed about it, and so did we, and we were pleased to find that when we got back there, that committee had worked hard, and they had gone out into 20-some villages. They were holding services. They had taught the things that we had left them. They had a few Bibles that we had left. They had passed out in Book of Mormons, they were very active. They kind of split themselves up into different zones, and in one zone was Michael. Those of you that may have seen the video of our last trip, it's his family that does all the singing. The little kids that were going like this in their routine, and he had gone into the northern district and really set up three congregations with the help of two other men. And the first Monday and Tuesday we were there, we taught classes in those villages. They came together and as one, and we could tell. We could tell they had been taught. We could tell by their questions. They pretty well knew the gospel of Christ. They pretty well knew what the Church of Christ stood for. We taught some things about the apostasy and church doctrine, and there were a lot of questions. It was just a neat experience to find that in our absence that the work had continued and was going strong. In another zone, a man by the name of Patrick and his wife Alice had gone out into 6 or 10 villages, and they had were meeting with the people there. And then our brother Moses Ohuru, 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 and sister Margaret Mora had gone into the northern district and did about 10 different new villages. So we were real thankful. They just kept us busy. We asked them for 1 or 2 days off a week, and we had 1 day in 6 weeks. And then we traveled to 5 hours to go and get a whiteboard and some other supplies. But it was just a blessing to be so busy, to feel needed, to be able to minister to them. It's a joy when they're all sitting there and taking notes and they're anxious to hear the Word of God. We ended up teaching classes or having services in 22 villages. We had about 38 service or classes. We blessed 10 or 15 babies, had 133 baptisms, and administered to over 100 people. And all that time, we knew it wasn't anything that we had done. We knew that it was an answer to a lot of people's prayers. We knew that the Lord had prepared those people to receive the things that we were giving them. Many of these people have been in and out of churches. Some of them had not. Some of them didn't know anything. But as we try to explain to them the simple truths of the gospel of Christ, they kept on saying, you know, we've never been taught that. That's pretty clear. We found out that how do I want to put this? Just like they told me, I guess. One of the things they explained, they said, we now know something new in Kenya. In Kenya, we have three types of ministry. He said that they told us that two different people told us that there. One, there's the man who has proclaimed himself as a minister and started a congregation out in a little village. He said, then there's the other one that has somehow gotten some education and went to a seminary and came back, and maybe the people elected him or appointed him as their pastor. And now there's the ministry that has come and has been called of God. And we were thankful because we were dealing with congregations and we were dealing with men, and some of them weren't members of the church yet. And they had come to the realization that although they had a strong desire and had really started a congregation, they understood that they didn't have the authority to perform the ordinances. That was a blessing, that was a concern of ours, that we'd come back and they would have gone on some other path and started a church and taken some of our stuff and doing some, you know, something of their own. I'd like to read from first chapter of Romans, 16th and 17th verse. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. From therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. I became more convinced than I had been, and I thought I was convinced before, that there's no need for us to be ashamed of the gospel of Christ. As we stood before many of the congregations and preached the gospel, it became plainer and plainer of the simple truths of the things that have been written and preserved and that are spoken of in the scriptures. We preached Jesus Christ that doesn't change as the scriptures. Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever. We continue to tell them that, and continue to tell them that that was a key to reaching salvation and knowing of the doctrine of Christ, that the doctrine that he set up when he walked among earth was the doctrine that we needed to follow today. I'm thankful for the fact that, as it says in the third chapter of Amos, that God will surely do nothing unless he reveals it to his servants, the prophets. That we have the prophecies written in the Holy Scriptures that are before us, that tells us of the end times that we live in, the conditions. Tells us of the falling away and the apostasy within the churches after Christ had set up the church. Talks of the restoration of the gospel and when it was to come forth. And that we have those records before us. We preach the six basic principles of the gospel that's in the sixth chapter of Hebrews. Time and time again, the plain, simple truths that are not hard to understand, but are made for all of mankind. And the fact that Christ himself set up his kingdom and placed in it his laws and his doctrine, gave his promises. I'm thankful for the fact that we have those holy prophets of old that prophesied of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon and of the great marvelous work that the Lord was going to do, the stick of Judah and the stick of Joseph, as spoken of in the 37th chapter of Ezekiel and Isaiah 29. And the fact that the Bible explains to us and teaches us that it will be in the mouth of two or three witnesses, all things will be confirmed. And that we have those witnesses in the Bible and the Book of Mormon before us. One of the scriptures that was used a lot and was well received there in Kenya was when we explained to them that Jesus himself, when he stood in Jerusalem and was teaching there, had spoken of the fact that there were other sheep that he had that weren't of that fold, but they were going to hear his voice. It's spoken of in the 10th chapter of John. And that he had come to the Americas and that he had walked among the children of men here in the Americas, and he had taught them the same gospel that he had taught in Jerusalem to fulfill that prophecy or that statement that he made in the 10th chapter of John. One of the problems that they have in Kenya is that they have the word Mormon and the word Mammon, they say it the same way, and it sounds the same. So when somebody was speaking to that people there about the Book of Mormon, they thought we or whoever were saying Mammon, and of course the Bible tells you to stay away from Mammon, and it's the riches of the world. And until we somebody explained that to us, and then we wrote it up on a board and showed that it was spelled different, and one was the name of a man, and the other one the definition of the riches of the world and that. They were having trouble, because as they went back into their villages, people questioned it. We had the opportunity to most of the villages that we went in, we tried to go in 2 different days, usually 2 days in a row. We had classes. One of the things that you find in Kenya is nothing happens the way that you want it to happen. It was never ceased to amaze you what happened to your schedule. As you'd wake up in the morning and I'd say to Brian, well, I wonder what's going to happen today, because it was never the way that we had planned. And something would come up, and, you know, without transportation, without phones, it would, so there was an emergency, we had to go to the hospital and meet somebody or something, we'd end up coming to a service 2.5 hours late, and the congregation is still waiting for us because that's the way it happens there. and although it drives us nuts, you know, and then there's American time and there's Kenyan time, and Kenyan time is any time within the hour of where you said you would be, but, we finally relaxed or tried to relax and didn't allow that to bother us. And that was a real problem. I mean, that really bothered both Brian and I. You know, but it surely, you know, we would be already a half hour late for the service, and we'd get in the car and we had our driver and we'd pick up Sister Margaret Mora at her house, and we're ready to roll. And, you know, we could get there. But no, she had to stop about 5 places and go see this little old sister that she hadn't seen for a while, or stop and see her dad that was sick, or bring something over to somebody else's house. And we were instead of going south, we were headed north out of town because she had to stop somewhere. And that's just the way that they are. You know, they don't let time bother them. And it's, I think, one of those cultural things that we just have to get used to. And it's hard, you know. It's probably harder for Brother Brian than myself. But, you know, Becky kids Brian about lining up all the paper clips on his desk. You know, everything is perfect. And, you know, I'm not that way. And after we'd been there about 5 weeks, I caught Brian. He was in my room, and he was straightening out everything on top of the table. I said, I think it's time you go home, Brian. But we were very fortunate. We had a couple things that could have happened that we worked through. One of them was Margaret had gotten official notice to report down at the district commissioner's office at 10 o'clock the next morning, and we went with her and went into the office, and this investigator jumped us and, you know, he really threatened us, and he said that the church was performing illegal meetings in Kenya, and we were going to be thrown in jail, and we had to register and on, and Brian tried to explain to him that we were trying to register, that there were some problems, and we weren't getting anywhere, but Margaret's husband came then, who's a lawyer, and kind of straightened him out, and we ended up telling the man what our beliefs were, left him articles of faith and practice. But one of the problems they have, and they have a law there that all societies have to register. One of the problems that they have is they have a lot of old witchcraft and things that causes problems for the government. And churches that are started that are revolutionary, and so they don't like those to start. And so they're very concerned when people, when are meeting and are not in our, in our registered congregation. They have a lot of problems with witchcraft. They have a lot of problems with what they call devil worshippers. Some of it, I think, is a phobia. It's something that doesn't exist, but in other cases, they're having a big problem in the town of Nairobi, which is the capital, that there's young girls, mostly, not all, early teenagers or before, that have been missing. It's in the paper every day there. They've attributed that to the devil worshippers. Unfortunately, we're considered among the devil worshippers. You know? And so every village that we went in after we left, somebody came in and told us that, you know, we believed in the Book of Mormon and that taught of the devil. And so we'd have to go back and counteract that. We were in the Northern District one day, and our brother that was with us, the Moses, had gotten word from one of the men that were in that village that his father-in-law in a neighboring village was very upset with him because he had led his daughter into a church that was devil worshippers. And Moses asked us if we would go and talk to his father-in-law, which we said we would be glad to. So on the way home that night, I'd ask him if, you know, is your father-in-law in a religion? And yes, he is. And he gave me the name, and it was Legion Maria, and it's a Kenyan religion. But they believe in the Bible. I thought we'd at least have some step with him if he said he believed in the Bible. But they're a little bit fanatical, and they carry swords and walk around carrying crosses, and we were, to say the least, a little leery of going over there and wondering what we would apprehend. But by the time we got there a couple days later, some other men had gone and talked to him and told him what we'd been teaching him. And the man's heart was turned. I ended up preaching in his house. I didn't mean to, but I was asked to say a few words. He accepted it very good. He invited us back. We ended up baptizing another one of his daughters the next day, and his son asked us back into the community to begin to teach and to preach in that community. That was another case that we knew it was the hand of the Lord that had softened his heart, because he was very distraught and upset. But we didn't experience any of that. We felt welcomed in his home, in fact. One of the things that was amazed us is what Brian and I had complained because people weren't at a meeting on time. And then as we went into the different villages and found out the conditions of the roads or that didn't exist and what they would go through prior to us getting there, it had put it in a different light. Our sister, Margaret Moore, is the lady that made contact with the church first. She's 30 years old. Her husband is a lawyer. He's only concerned with the things of the world and really gives her a hard time about the church and her work in the church. She has a 3.5-year-old daughter and has adopted 2 young boys. The mother's died and father died. She's a busy woman. Before we would meet her at 9 o'clock in front of her house, she would have gotten up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock, walking 2 miles into town to buy vegetables and those types of things, come back, milk the cow, cook the dinner, do the ironing, do the washing, and be out in front of her house dressed to kill at 8:30 or 9 o'clock. She already had a full day in. Our brother Moses Ahuru, who has been now called as an elder and ordained. He lives in a little village about 25 kilometers from the town of Kisi where we were sitting. He is out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we drove to his house and the road got worse and worse and got down to a path about this wide, and we had to stop, and then the path disappeared, and we walked 2 miles to the village. He would normally get up at 4:30 in the morning and have to walk about 8 or 10 miles to get to a road where he could get a taxi or some motor vehicle. And he was with us every day. Many days he didn't make it home. Some days he didn't even try, as he, you know, if it was too late. And he would stay in town. He stayed with us a couple times. I ask that you remember Brother Moses in your prayer and his wife Nora. She's very sweet. She's young. They have 2 young daughters, 13 months and 3.5 years, I think. He's got a little farm. We were concerned when he was with us every day. He had said he needed to plant corn because the rain was coming, began to rain, you know, every day. And we ended up asking him if he needed to take some time off and to go and plant. And he said that his wife had done it, and that's pretty typical. The wives will work the fields and milk the cows. And, you know, I didn't believe it, but he admitted he wouldn't have any idea how to milk a cow. You know, Margaret was kidding him. She said if Moses had to milk the cow, he'd give it back to the calf. I asked him, and he said, well, yeah, I probably would. that's pretty typical of the woman's tasks there. They're in charge of, you know, they do a lot of the farming. The heavy work the men do, but sister Nora is, you know, Moses is 35, and she's quite a bit younger than he is. So I don't know how old she is, probably 26, 27, just sweet. I reconfirmed a theory I have as we went out into the villages and got away from the eating at the hotel that we had stayed at. In fact, I didn't eat there once this time. And the food was a lot better. The theory I have is that the women in the Church of Christ are the best cooks in the world. They still stand on that as we had some very good food this time. I mean, we had that ugali that we talked about last time, and it's just as bad as it was last time. They tried, you know, to give us rice. They tried to give us potatoes. They have a cooking banana that when it's cooked up, it tastes like a potato, and they tried more of that. But normally, I was there a week without having ugali. But then the bottom fell out and we had it every day. But, you know, they eat, you know, it's absolutely amazing the carbohydrates they eat. We had Brian and I decided we were going to cook in our room. And we bought a little stove and we cooked every night ourselves. And we'd buy pasta and we made spaghetti and you know, we were kidding about tonight's the Italian night. We had a Hungarian goulash one night and we, you know, did all kinds of things and kind of made fun of it. Moses stayed with us one night and we had spaghetti and we gave him 2 big plates of spaghetti and then he had about 4 pieces of bread or 5 pieces of bread. I mean, and he doesn't have an ounce of fat on him, but he walks 8 or 10 miles a day, I suppose. One of the things we had done there, the needs there are great. There are a lot of physical needs. There's a lot of poverty. They don't have any money. I ask them about, you know, what income most people make. And, of course, most of them have 3 acres to 5 acres of land, and they live off of that. And they might sell some of their produce or whatever to get some cash, but it's limited. A man going to work in a field all day for 10 to 12 hours, plowing or hoeing by hand, you know, physical labor, would make 100 shillings a day. Which is about $1.40, and so, you know, they can't. We noticed things like we were drinking purified water, and the bottles to them. I mean, you know, the first time we threw one away, you know, everybody jumped on it. So we started saving them, and we threw tin cans away from soup in that, you know, there were our tomato paste, and the people that were cleaning the room would take it out of the garbage and clean it and bring it home and use it for something. And, you know, they don't have anything like that. And so we started saving all that for members or people that we were visiting. I have some slides here I would like to show. Not as many as last time, but this is a groundbreaking ceremony in the village of Kababi, which we're beginning to build a church building. This land that we're standing on is given to us by Margaret Mora's grandfather. He's a Seventh-day Adventist. We're in the process of getting the legal deed for the piece of land. We have delivered some cement at that site, and they're going to dig a cistern and cement it so they can collect water to mix concrete in that later. The rainy season is just starting. And about the time they'll be building, there won't be any rain, and they'd have to haul water and pay for it otherwise. We met there. This is the site of the first place that we had met the last trip, and it was the first Sunday we were there. We met, and Brian had preached, and then we had a little ceremony as a groundbreaking. I have a picture here of our room. Brian and I had separate rooms next to each other. As you can see, his is perfect. There's nothing in that room but a bed, and we went out and scouted around and got a table and chairs and found that bookcase, and he had all our books that we had brought, and we were going to ship Book of Mormons and that there, and I went down to the shipping company and asked them about shipping, and they weighed everything up and were ready to bring it up on the cash register, and they told me if I'd leave one book back, I could save $100. And I thought that was a good deal, and then I happened to think, I said, if I'm saving $100, what is the cost going to be? And it was about $1,200. So we didn't ship any. We carried them carried an extra suitcase and carried books, and we're up at the maximum of the weight. So he had those in his room. He's got everything lined up perfectly. And he really does. If you've ever been in his office. What? Yeah, actually those ones that you see there are the ones that Ruth got for us. Ruth's back there. The Swahili ones, I think. Yeah, most of them are in English. Although we did have excerpts from, and we passed all those out. This is my room. It's not quite as nice. It was right next door, but that's our kitchen. And Brian's cooking. We bought this little stove. It's a propane stove. It works really slick. And we cooked every night, and we usually had for dessert a pineapple. Sister Margaret Mora runs a little business and wholesales pineapples, trucks them in from a different area of Kenya, and sells them to the vendors in the marketplace. And she would pick out every couple of days a couple pineapples for us. I think we were having soup this night. But we'd get onions and leeks and tomatoes and chop them up, and we ate carrots and cucumbers and then a lot of times we would have pasta or something. We did buy a coffee pot. Everything's 220 volts, so you have to buy the things over there. And a coffee pot really helped us. It's amazing. They grow coffee in the country, and you can't get a good cup of coffee. I like this next picture. And it's a picture of Brother Brian McIndoo holding Brian McIndoo. It's a little boy that was named after Brian that he had just blessed. Was born since our last trip. It's a nephew of Margaret's. Actually, there's about three kids named after him, I think. We pulled into a town one morning, and they told us just as we drove up, a little baby boy had been born in the hut that was next to where we were meeting. And they asked us to come in and bless the baby, which we did. It was about 10 minutes old at that time. And they named it Brian. We ended up blessing about 8 babies in that village. This is Sister Margaret Mora. She is the one that made the contact with the church to begin with. That's outside of a building, probably 30 by 30, thatched roof, adobe or whatever. And we had just met in there and had 100 people in that for the service. And, you know, it wasn't too bad, really. The thatched roof is considerably cooler than the metal roofs. I wouldn't have a metal roof there. I don't know why they all don't have... Well, I guess the thatched roof actually costs more. This is a building that somebody lets them use. This is at a class that we held. I actually took this picture to put in the Advocate. I've got a letter from him, and that's why I took Margaret's too. This is, the man's name is Patrick. His wife's name is Alice. She's one of those excellent cooks. It tries different things. Patrick had lived in the States for 3 years, 1988-89. He had went to a seminary here. He had been in Orlando, Florida, and someplace in Pennsylvania. He speaks pretty good English. No. He's got two young sons that are hurting. He's got a son that's about, I think, 14. That while we were there the first time, he was in the hospital in Nairobi and he had a brain tumor that they had removed. And while we were there, we sent our driver into Nairobi to see his wife, and he picked up the son and brought him back. And because of the tumor, he's blind. But they hope that some of that will come back. And he's got a drainage coming out of his head. And the hospitals there are... hospital there. That we went into a hospital one day in Kisii, to administer we went in to see a lady that lives in Moses's village that had been in there, and she had a big goiter under here, and it was choking her, and she had a young baby that I think was only a couple weeks old, but they had sent the baby home because she couldn't get up. She was semi-conscious, was really out of it, and we administered to her, and then we came back about a day later, and when we walked in the room, she stood up and said hi to us, and we administered to her again, and she thanked us, and we left, and Moses stayed, and she said that after we had left, that at the time that we were saying a prayer over her, she had received a blessing. She could feel strength in her legs. That right after we left, she got up out of bed, went to the bathroom, went into the kitchen and ate, and was really, within days was back home. The last day we were in Kisii, Patrick had run down to somebody else's home and got off on the phone and called me and said that another son was sick. I thought it was the same one, but it was another one, was sick, and he was bringing him into the hospital, and he'd have to carry him down to the road and then hire a taxi cab to bring him in, and he didn't have the money and wanted to know if we could meet him, which we said we would be glad to. And he has tetanus. And he was in bad shape. Brian was actually there when he got out of the taxi, but he was as stiff as a board. When I saw him, I thought he was dead and had been dead for hours or something, and he was really sick. We saw him again the next day and he was doing better. But the hospital, it's unbelievable. I mean, I could barely stand it in the room that he was in. It was so bad. It was dark and smelly, and you're walking down the hall, and there's big plotches of blood on the floor. And, Brian McIndoo was a homicide policeman in Phoenix, He's looking at the blood to see if there was trauma and, how it was spilled on the floor and everything. He said, Brian, you're not at your old job. Yeah. And, I wouldn't bring my dog there, but I hope I never have to go. They don't have good medical care. It's probably where back early 1900s or something, I would imagine. In fact, I would think of that, driving into these little towns and mud all over and these little stone houses or whatever, shops along the road. And I thought, that must have been like it was here in America is in the 1700s, 1800s or something, in those little communities that you read about, and hardships. Yet again, you have the things, and the crazy part about it is right in the midst of this is a place you can get email. We're in an email, trying to send email one night, and a guy walks in with a chicken, throws it on the floor, sits down at the computer, sends his email, picks up the chicken, and walks out. I mean, just the combination. You do a click. There's something wrong here. And you didn't think anything of it. We had. Let me stay on track here. This next picture is when we went down to that other tribe to preach there. This is out in front of the church. That lady on the left is named Lucilia, and she runs a gift shop in that town. And we had met her the first time we were there, and she had asked us to come and preach, which Brian did. This man here is our driver, Josephat. He was our driver last time. We paid him through budget car rental to drive us. You might remember the last time, the first day, that he had told us that he prays about the fact that he'd be able to take missionaries when they come to Kenya, because then he gets to come to church. And he helped us all the time. He was filling out forms for the baptisms. He was helping, and we ended up giving him a Book of Mormon and some tracts. The last day, he brought us to his home. We met his wife. and children. He had them all coming in the living room, and he told them to sit down, and he said, I want these men to talk to you. And so we left him that book and explained some of the things to his wife that was, she was a little apprehensive, I think. But we've got it set up to come again the next time that we're there, and I really expect to see him in the Church of Christ. The other man on the right there is Moses. He's now an elder in the Church of Christ. And he needs our prayers. He's going to be busy. This is that church that we were at. There was about 400 people there. The village that we were in were the Maasai, the ones that have the big earrings and the red robes and the walking sticks and all that. And none of them in the congregation were like that. They were all dressed like we are. I don't know, you know, the rest of the town, I don't know where they came from. We were, you know, wondering how it was going to be there. It was like home. This is an African inland church. This building was all built by an American missionary, 1979 or something. It's all black building, including the podium and everything. And Brian preached there. Did a nice job. This is usually the areas that we preached in, or something that looked like this. This is the village of Oracho, where we have probably a dozen members now. They had rented this building. They usually meet out in the open. They had put a tarp out in front here. This was after our meeting. During the meeting, they closed the local school down, and about 70 of the kids came and sat in the, around the edges, including the teachers. And they asked a lot of questions. The kids really were good. They were very attentive. And we were thankful for that opportunity. But that was, that's a typical congregation. Here is another congregation that we visited that we now have members in. This is a what they would call a temporary structure. It's stick and clay, metal roof. That building on the left is a house or a big shed where they sort tea, I think. There's a lot of tea growing in that area. They're on borrowed land here, and this is inside of Brian teaching a class inside. I really like this little building. It was really, this building, out behind it was a big valley. And the only thing I could think of is, if you've ever been down to Branson and Silver Dollar City in that little chapel that they have, and that looks out over the valley in the Ozarks. You ever been there? This spot, the building looks a little different, but the spot is the spot just like that. This is the ordination of Brother Moses. We were having a class there at the Catholic guest house. And we did it the day there were, we taught a class, or Brian taught a class. And we told him that the idea was that some of the different leaders from the different villages would come, and he'd pass out things and show them how to teach that class when they went back to their village. Well, the problem was they ended up about 60 people came, and we were expecting 20. It worked good. And he taught a class on the Book of Mormon geography. And he was really worried about it being too deep. At the end of the class, they all had a little map that showed where the land of, land of desolation and all that, you know, and it's spoken of in the Book of Mormon, where all that is located in Central America. And they really did good. Margaret's grandfather came to the class, and he doesn't talk Swahili or English, and speaks Kisi. And I didn't think he was going to get anything out of it. His mind's like a steel trap. I mean, he'd ask questions, he was right on. You know, all that geography and that, you know, you wouldn't think he'd know anything about. I mean, he was right on. I couldn't believe it. He wears a little hat that sits up on top of his head, and he carries a cane, and he reminds me of Dr. Seuss. He's a real nice man. One of the when I had gone to the immunization clinic here in Overland Park and was going to get my shots and that to travel, and Sue and I were sitting there at the table. I had her come with me so that she'd hear, so I'd remember, because I don't know medical terms, you know. And the lady was telling me, was asking me where I was going, what I was going to be doing, and she said, well, yeah, fortunately, you won't be eating in villages. Wrong. I ate in a village every day. And she said, and besides that, you won't be in the water, you know, for the parasites and everything. I said, well, we got a problem. Because I was in the water quite a bit of the time. And had to laugh, because she said, well, if you get in the water, don't get above it, your knees. And, you know, I was in the water up here for an hour and a half or something, I think. But this particular area is probably okay. Moses told me while we were down in the water and that if we would go into a neighboring, where a neighboring tribe is, where we had visited a village, he said, if we do any baptisms there, I'm going to get in the water, and don't you get in, because there's parasites in the water that will attack your body. But I don't think they would. This was a beautiful little spot where we had our first baptism service this trip. Baptized 19 people. We had about 100 people come out of the fields that were up in here. We're lined up along this creek or river and watched the service. I think this is that same congregation. This young man here, who we had seen at our classes 2 weeks before then, ask all kinds of questions. Yeah, after the confirmation service, he asked if he could bear a testimony, and he had said that the night before, when asked the question about the baptism, he had gone home, and he and his wife had both decided that they were not going to be baptized. That they'd been baptized in another church, and he had been told that, you know, didn't make any difference what church it was, that he had met the obligation. And he had a dream and was woken up that night and or had a vision, and an angel came to him and told him that he needed to be baptized. And so he changed his plan and was baptized the next day. We were thankful to see that they were having those types of spiritual experiences that would direct them. This is another group that had... I don't know exactly why I took that one. This is Sister Nora, Moses' wife. That's her father there. This was at their village. This is another baptism service in the village of Kababi, where we're probably going to build the first building. We get the land through. They have 12 to 20 members there. It's kind of centrally located. The building that we hope to be able to build there is going to be a little larger, and we hope it will be used by as kind of a headquarters for the work there in Kenya. And it would be used by all of them. It wouldn't belong to that local, but it would belong to the Church of Christ in Kenya. I took that just because of the sign that they had made up. This is the confirmation service of that. Three of them, we had them sit, you know, six at a time, and would lay our hands on them and walk down the line. One of the things we experienced that, you know, in the church, we aren't used to that many baptisms on a day. We had 19 and then 57 and then 46 and then 11 or 12. And the forms. We've got to do something about those forms. This is Brother Moses out in front of his congregation. The kids are on the first pew. He's back, you know, most of the adults are back here. There's 14 people in his congregation. This is taken on the last Sunday we were there. We organized a formal local in that village with 14 members and an elder. They elected a secretary and a treasurer. They're going to look to see if they can't purchase or have somebody donate a piece of land that they can meet at and then build a temporary structure there. They're meeting out on underneath a big avocado tree. And the problem is when it rains, you know, they really can't meet. It's a beautiful spot, however. This is in a village that's probably a mile or two from his actual home. He comes over there and holds services. When he's traveling like he was with us on Sundays, and he did most of our interpreting. I mean, he's really sharp. There's two young men that are members there that do some teaching in Sunday school. This is a typical temporary structure made with poles and branches. Keeps the sun out. It doesn't work for the rain. But they had split logs there that they're sitting on for benches. They did have a podium here, which was unusual. Usually they didn't. Any chairs and that they would have, they carry from the homes. One place that we had met there in Katuka, we came back a half hour later, and the only thing that was there was that shelter. I mean, all the chairs were back, all in the homes and everything, and everything was dismantled. We're hoping to be able to help them as we form congregations to have a temporary shelter that have a metal roof or something that would keep them out of the rain. The next 3 months that we were planning on going back in early January, sometime about that time frame, we have left them some money to try to function with. We told them what we had and tried to get them to budget it so they have some idea how to use funds. And with about three or four passes at it, they actually did pretty good. What we asked them to do, we got some specific things that we would like to have done between now and January. One was we hired Margaret's husband as their lawyer to get the deed registered for that land so we'd have legal title to it. That's a problem because the church has to be registered in Kenya. So we're proceeding with that. Yeah, he hopes to have that done by January. I don't think so, but he's a lawyer and likes to give promises that he can't meet. But the important thing that the process starts, because I think it takes 6 months from what I've heard. And then we've asked them to gone out and outreach to a lot of new villages. And what we've really told them is that don't go out to new villages anymore. I mean, don't not do it, but don't do it on purpose. Spend the time teaching here in the congregations and building up strong locals and making sure that the families of the men that are members and their kids and that, understand the gospel and are taught. And that's what we're hoping to do. They need Sunday school supplies and books and they have nothing like that. Most of those villages that were in there, the man that was acting as their leader might have a Bible, probably not. We probably gave him the only Bible he had. And we tried to leave 2 Book of Mormons in each village. We hope to bring more back next time. We will bring more back next time. So they have to kind of pass that or those books around. They don't have any Sunday school supplies or anything, and so we can help them there maybe with some blackboards and Sunday school supplies. We have a unique opportunity in one of the villages, possibly two. There's a school near the church that man Patrick that I had the picture of, he's on the, board of directors of or something, and their congregation has tried to help that church a little bit. And in fact, now the headmaster and one of the teachers have been baptized. They've already used the Book of Mormon that we left for Patrick, and they're teaching it in their school. They teach the any book that they can get, really. I left them the book, Between the Covers of the Book of Mormon, written in story form, and a workbook that is supplied with that now, which has vocabulary words and a little test every day, and it, you know, teacher's instructions, and I'm sure that they'll use that. But we have the opportunity there that they would use any supplies, any classes or anything that we would have, they would use, because they're non-existent. We were in there, there's 150 kids in the school, there's 7 classes. You walk in the class and there's a blackboard on the wall and that's it. Never saw a textbook. They were doing math in there and up on the board, but they had workbooks, little notebooks that the kids wrote in. But I think the teacher writes everything. I think he's got a book and he writes everything on the board and they copied it down. And that's how they teach. I said earlier, we were really, really encouraged at the amount of work that had been accomplished there, and that the Lord had prepared so many hearts, and that we were able to preach and to teach and to have it accepted. That it was an unusual experience. The enthusiasm. And the knowledge that they had, and their acceptance of the plain, simple things of the gospel. I would be amazed at. I taught a class on the apostasy one day. That gets a little deep, but I was trying to keep it real simple. But you know, and I thought that during the class that, you know, I was talking to the wall, and I didn't think that they were, you know, catching. We had bought a whiteboard, and I had written down a timeline and, you know, things that happened, and had 570 AD and 1830 and all that on it. And that afternoon, Brian asked before he started his class if anybody had any questions. They had that. I mean, they had their notes. Couple days later, a guy pulled out his notes. He said, "The other day you said this, you know." And it was really a joy to see, and that they were able to comprehend. I was walking down the road with another fellow, and he had heard me preach about 2 days before that, and he started quoting every scripture reference I had used. And he had been one that had been against the church, and really had had some miraculous experiences himself. I would, I'm running out of time. I would like to say that the work there in Kenya is just begun. I think we have a opportunity there in many other villages and in the villages that we're already in. I do have a concern that we need to be able to support the members that are there. I'd ask for your prayers for our brother Moses, who's the only elder and minister in Kenya, and with 159 members spread over 22 congregations, you know, he's going to be a little thin. They do meet together a lot. A lot of those are villages that are fairly close, and so he's hoping to have sacrament services once a month in the different villages where three or four villages might get together, and We've given him some aid to be able to travel to those places, and so that he isn't held back, and we'll be able to administer to anybody that can get a hold of him. But he needs our prayers. His wife needs our prayers. He's going to have a lot of duties. He's going to have a lot of responsibility. She's really supportive of him. Her name is Nora. His name is Moses. Their last name is Ohuru. We have to pray that his crops come in. He's got enough corn right now to last him, he thinks, until this crop that he planted comes. But they live like that, you know, from crop to crop. If the rains are there, and so he's making it a matter of prayer, and we can help him by praying also. As we have been trying to explain to them there to build up strong locals, that's exactly what we need to do here, is to have the strong local congregations that we might support the work throughout the world. That we have strong families and strong youth groups and activities, and we continue to grow right here within the States. We can see and we know that in the day and the time we live in, that we believe that these are the end times, that the gospel has to go out into the world, that the little Church of Christ has got an awesome responsibility in accomplishing that. Yet again, we can see that when we go to places like Kenya and Honduras or Yucatan or wherever we might be, that, you know, when it's the Lord's will, it gets accomplished. I was thankful for the prayers and for the support of everybody here. We could feel it. I was thankful for the labors and the works of the people there and their preparation and their continuing of the handful or so of people that were working to continue spreading the gospel message. We've just scratched the surface there, I'm sure. We look like we might have some outreach in a neighboring country, in Tanzania or whatever it's called, and there's a possibility in another country. I would assume that we would be in the next year or so be able to reach out into those countries, and we're looking forward to it. I think that the important thing for us to remember is that we have to be, for that work to grow, that work to be sustained, that we have a responsibility in the Church of Christ and the members here in the states to be steadfast and strong, to be diligent and to continue to support our local congregations and our families and support the general church and the outreaches. But the important thing is that we seek first the kingdom of God. We taught there the plain simple truth that someday that everybody in the whole human family of Adam is going to, we're going to stand before God and be judged according to our works. That's what the Bible says. You know exactly where I'm reading from in the Book of Revelations, and you know I believe that's true. And we have to be prepared. Of importance, our relationship with our Heavenly Father. How are we relating to Him? How are we living our lives? Are we setting the example for others? And we have to take a look at it within ourselves. I have to. You have to. If this work is going to progress, we have to be ready. We have to be numbered among the righteous. And as the Scriptures teach us, this is our day and time. There's not any other time that we're going to get. We're not going to get another time. You know, this is our day, a day of our probation, our time to serve our Heavenly Father. And so we have to make sure that we aren't caught up with the cares of the world. We all are. I am. You know, but we have to separate that. We've got to somehow pray for discernment that we'd separate those things and not get lost and not live up to what Christ Himself expects of us as members of His church. The scripture that I was going to close with, which I will just talk through, is the sixth chapter of Ephesians telling us to put on the whole armor of God. And you know, it's the one that we use in Sunday school for everybody, and it's a plain, simple truth that God has provided the way for us to be able to endure. He desires that we be with Him eternally. But He gives us a choice. We can choose. We can choose the life of righteousness, or we can choose a life of unrighteousness. We can choose to follow the world, or we can choose to follow the example of Jesus Christ. He doesn't force any of us. He allows us to make our own choice so He can reward us. tells there in the book of Revelations when we're going to be judged, it's going to be out of the books. And the books are written for our benefit. It behooves us to study them, to search out the scriptures, to know what the requirements are, and to know that God has placed on earth his church. He has placed on earth the ordinances and his doctrine that we would be able to endure. He isn't out there to punish us. Now, he will punish us if we don't yield. But that's not his intent. His intent is, and he says, come unto me. And his arms of mercy are extended, and he desires that each one of us humbly come before his throne and submit our lives to him and change him. And that's what he requires. And that's the process that we have to be in. If we want to be a missionary church, if we want to reach out to all the nations of the world, we must be a church that is among the righteous and live our lives according to Jesus Christ. And that's why we have the scriptures before us. We've got a special blessing in the church. We've got two testimonies of Jesus Christ. We've got the Bible and we've got the Book of Mormon. You know, in the mouth of two or three witnesses, all things are confirmed. It's just a marvelous thing. And there's just so much strength in the gospel, you know, that even as we were teaching there in Kenya and became amazed at just to seeing how everything just fits into place. And you know, I've known that for years, but to have it reinforced to you and to be able to see people that had heard it the first time and you know that they locked in on it and they could see the basic simple truths of the gospel of Christ and the hope that they have. And so that's the hope that I have. That's the hope that I think that you have. I hope that you will leave here tonight. You'll think about that work out in Kenya and keep that in your prayers. You'll remember Brother Moses and his wife. That you'll remember Patrick and his sons. I forgot. Yeah, I told you about the other son. And there are so many needs there, that physical and medical, the church can't change all that. It just can't. But we can bring to them the gospel of Christ and change the spiritual things through prayers and supplications and through outreaches. And I believe the Lord is counting on us. And I know that his hand has been in it, and I am encouraged. I am encouraged for the enthusiasm that we see among the church. I mean, it's been exciting to be a part of it and to see people respond to the outreach. And I look forward with anticipation and hope for the years to come. And I know that we're just beginning, that the church was going to grow, that the word is going to go out to all the nations of the world, just as promised us in the Bible and the Book of Mormon. Thank you for your time.